This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, hello everyone. Welcome back to the Disability Study channel at the New Books Network. Today, I am very happy to introduce our new guest speaker, Dr. Kim Nielsen, to join us to introduce her newest book, Money, Marriage, and Madness. So again, first thing I want to invite Professor Kim Nielsen to introduce herself to us.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. I am Dr. Kim Nielsen, Distinguished University Professor of Disability Studies at the University of Toledo.
Okay, thank you so much for your introduction. So next question will involve you interested in disability studies. So I want to know why you took interest in the field, I want to say the promising field of disability studies.
For me, it is the best way that I can attempt to do an intersectional analysis as a historian. When I was in graduate school, we always complained about how other faculty, everybody we read, failed to do a strong intersectional analysis. I got out in the field, discovered it's harder to do than it is to complain about. And I think that using disability as an analytic is the very best way, the most effective way I've discovered to think intersectionally. I find it really helpful. I find it an analytical tool and a topic that can be used almost anywhere in history. I think it's interesting. It's smart. There's lots of great work going on.
Yeah, thank you so much for your answer. So let's go to your book. So my first question will be invite you to talk about Anna Ault's personal life, such as her marriage before being institutionalized in 1973.
Okay. So this is a book about a woman named Anna Barbara Blaser Meese Ault. And I use her to talk about the social power of diagnosis, the legal precarity in which women existed in the 19th century, the ways that ableism and sexism work together, or ableism and patriarchy work together. So Anna Ault was a woman who arrived in the U.S. as a teenager. She into Ohio. She was married to a man who became a physician in Ohio in the 1830s and 40s. They established a home in Chillicothe, Ohio, where he was a physician. She was the physician's wife who helped with medicines, preparation, basically did triage. They had two small children. the marriage was very tumultuous. They eventually divorced. She came out of that with some cash. She moved to, she married again and moved to Madison, Wisconsin, where she opened up a physician practice. There they also had, she had a lot of status because she was a physician, but she also faced a lot of violence in their household and a lot of violence from her second husband, George, that the entire community knew about.
Okay, thank you again for your answer about Anna Cole's early life. So my next question will be about Anna Cole's career as a female physician in the mid-19th century.
I use Ott to talk about the power of the physician. But she was a physician in Madison, Wisconsin, one of two white female physicians in the state at this point in time. She had arrived in Madison having claimed to gone to one of the medical colleges for women in Philadelphia. She established a practice that lasted about 15 years or so. It's hard to know exactly what she did there, but there's evidence that she did surgeries, she delivered babies, she did, the things that a 19th century physician would do, helped folks with diseases. She had her office, most likely off of the Capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, but was a certainly considered. Her status as a female physician in the mid-19th century both gave her some honor and attention, but it also made people skeptical of her. There's both a privilege and a stigma there that went on with that status.
Okay, thank you so much again for your answer. So my next question will be Anna Oates' experience after being admitted to the Wisconsin State Hospital for Insane, especially how she took agency in her everyday life later.
Ott was a woman who stood out because she had a lot of money that she had control of in her own funds. She was a female physician. She also stood out in town because she and her husband had a very lovely, huge house on Lake Mendota. At the same time, as I said, he was a very violent man, and the community all knew that he, at various times had thrown her out in the street in the middle of a Wisconsin snowstorm, she and her daughter from her first marriage. The volatile relationship was very much in the public sphere, and people knew about this. I guess I want to put, one doesn't wake up in an insane asylum with no history to that. And the both stigma and the honor that she had the community, made her, in essence, stand out. Eventually her husband, her two other local physicians who were her colleagues, had her declared incompetent and legally insane. She was admitted to the Wisconsin State Hospital for the Insane and ended up staying there for 20 years as an inmate patient. She also was placed under guardianship. I think we see here the gendered nature of diagnosis. She had diagnoses given very stereotypically to women in this time period. And she was admitted and spent the last 20 years of her life there. I think her time in the insane asylum is interesting because it was awful. It was absolutely horrid. The medical records indicate this. The investigations of the place indicate this. Every information we have about this, that this was not a pleasant place to be. At the same time, she clearly sought agency in her own life by shaping her daily activities. She had seamstresses come into the asylum. She had food brought into the asylum. We have a little bit of evidence about how she perhaps practiced medicine in the asylum, but she worked, she clearly sought, despite the controls around her, to exercise some agency in her own life.
Okay, thank you again for your answer about, Anna Gold's everyday life in the asylum. So my next question is about her economic life later.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's so interesting to me because this was a woman with a lot of funds in her own that she had worked very hard to get from her first husband, and that she had garnered in land investments and in property around Madison, Wisconsin, and throughout the entire Midwest. With both husbands, she had various legal arrangements so that she owned the she had access to and controlled her material goods. When she was institutionalized, she was declared incompetent and given an economic and legal guardian. That guardian, however, was not her second husband. The court declared a local lawyer in town to be her guardian. You know, there's evidence that she complained loudly about the possibility of her ex-husband or her husband at that time being her guardian. So the courts appointed a local attorney, and that local attorney had power to say yes or no to all of her expenditures. So legally, she had no control over funds at all. Her guardian, however, let her spend and seems not to have intervened. So while in the asylum, she ordered furniture, new clothing several times a year, fruits and vegetables, newspapers to read, books to read. There's some evidence that she also paid to have carriage rides, boat rides in the summertime. And as I said, some evidence that she had a medicine brought into the asylum that she paid for from a local drugstore, which always makes me wonder if she exercised her life as a doctor in the asylum. But asylums were really active economic places, and she very much contributed to that.
So thank you so much again for your answer. So now it's our last question is, just beyond and its oath on life. I want to ask you to talk about, how biography could be a powerful and effective tool in historical research.
To me, history matters because there are people in it, people who have daily lives, who are restricted, who exercise great agency, who people who are admirable, people who are despicable, but it matters because there's people in it. And I think by using biography, we can see how large social structures, which are often difficult to understand, actually shape individual people's lives. Like, you know, we can talk about racism, but if we don't talk about how it affected people, it doesn't matter. We can talk about capitalism, right, or institutionalization or ableism, all of these large social forces, but we need to know how they impact people and how people resisted them and lived within them. So I think biography is really powerful because we can see how in a historical moment, these large social forces actually shaped people's lives, and people lived with those large social forces. And as I said, both exercised agency and lacked agency all at the same time, excuse me. I also think biography, when well-written, can just be fun to read. It is always my go-to when I need to work, but I don't feel like working. So I can rationalize I'm working away while I read a great biography. I think we like to see ourselves in history. And often we can, as individuals, can connect to historical figures through biography. It's a way to see into the past that I think is particularly powerful.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Nikin-Luzer. Thank you so much for your answer again. So at the end of our talk today, I want to recommend all of my, audience, please think about buying a copy of Dr. Kim Nielsen's newest book, Money, Marriage, and Madness, which is a fantastic book about women's experience and encounter with mental health institution in the late 19th century. So thank you, Dr. Kim Nielsen. Thanks for your coming to our podcast today again.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.